Changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is, what day is it? Well, for you, it would be August 6, 2026. For me, it's just slightly a day later in the temporal void. It's actually August 5th for me. I'm pre-recording this because by the time you're hearing it, I will be on the road again with my grandson, and we're heading down to South Texas to do some shark fishing and probe around for some other big fish, too, while we're there. We'll be there just for a couple days, just getting ready to go back to school, and I thought this 15 would be a good trip for him. So occasionally I tell you guys about my personal life. I've been doing this for 18 years, and I think I'm one of the more public personalities out there. Anyway, I really hope you guys enjoy today's show. I've got a great lineup for you today. Chris Rossini and Ron Paul, will be talking about the Empire of Lies and how it's not in good health. I obviously completely agree with that. I do think that there is as always, and there has been from the very beginning, a tendency to oversell how strong Iran has been standing up in this conflict. And I'll give you a little piece of knowledge about how bad things are for Iran right now. Doesn't mean they're going to, you know, cave in or anything, but it is not like they're standing toe to toe with the United States. It just isn't. And I don't know why we keep having people try to rehash that fantasy. It just doesn't make any sense. Nicole Sauce will talk about using summer garden abundance for preparedness for fall and winter. Nick Ferguson will talk about dealing with a tree that keeps suckering up from the roots. Mike Melito will talk about BOLO. That's be on the lookout for, right? That's the law enforcement thing. We know this guy, he's got red hair and green eyes, and he's carrying a sign that says, "I'm stupid. Look out for him," right? He's in a red car or whatever it is. Yeah, but what about BOLO guns? You ever heard of BOLO guns? This is exactly what it sounds like. Be on the lookout for guns. Guns that you want to keep an eye out for. Guns that you want in your mental registry should you happen to find them at a gun show or something like that. Antonio Gatto, who we haven't heard from in a while, will talk about, should you use a rental management company versus self-managing rental properties? I haven't heard that segment. I'm going to listen to it because I may actually differ with him on this, even though he's got more experience than me. It depends, as always. But we'll see what he has to say. Because I listened like the very beginning, and I thought I heard him leaning toward no. And I think in this situation, maybe yes. We'll see. And then I am going to actually pull a chapter for my segment right out of my own book, Chapter 11 in Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life. That law is what will happen is more powerful than what should. And there's a lot of lessons right now in life for people from that vantage point. With that, let's go ahead and drop right on into it today. And lead off with Chris and Dr. Paul about the Empire of Lies being in poor health.
We live in a globalized scam. It's not local. If you have a neighborhood scam, it could end quickly. And the more you go up the scale, if it's a state, it takes a little longer. If it's a nation, it takes a little longer to end. Well, we're on the global scale, and it's a scam. And by that, I mean lies, as Dr. Paul has called it, the empire of lies. It's really apparent, especially with President Trump, that we live in an empire of lies. It's all lies, you know, so it takes a while because of the scale of it to end. You know, it's not a neighborhood, you know, Ponzi scheme. But there are signs that it is coming to an end. The military empire is trapped, unlike it ever has been, in fact. We've, throughout my entire life, beat up on all these nations that couldn't do anything to us. And we finally have bumped up against one that fights back and has fought back. And, you know, it's surviving and it's puzzled. The president is upset. You know, it has not gone as planned. And this is without Russia and China. This is just Iran by itself, you know, so we can tell this long arc. We haven't won a war since World War II. Yes, we pushed Saddam out of Kuwait. You know, that we shouldn't have even done that. But we haven't won a war since World War II. The Fed is trapped. That's another thing. They're trapped. No matter what they do, they are going to create angrier and angrier Americans. The American people are waking up by the tens of millions that something is wrong in Washington, D.C. with this Israeli influence. You know, and they're educating themselves going back through all these wars. Hey, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, this was not for us. And, you know, President Thomas Massie, the government makes it very apparent themselves. They can't stop telling us how much they stand with Israel. So all of this overextension is showing us that the empire is not healthy. It is falling apart. And this is how empires end. But, you know, as human beings, we want instant gratification. We want some kind of Berlin Wall moment. But we're seeing it over time, over decades, that this giant scam is coming to an end. They are overextended. Now, when it ends, I don't know. Is it in our lifetime? I don't know. But it's heading in that direction. And the more people that are patriotic in the right way, not patriotic, let's go bomb everybody, patriotic and let's take care of America, when that happens, the better off we'll be.
All we have to do is follow the intent of the founders, that we ought to have a system of government, that government should be limited, and that people aren't allowed in a society of liberty. You're not allowed to lie, cheat, steal, or kill other people. People say, well, I don't believe in all that stuff. But unfortunately, our governments do.
So look, I completely agree that we are reaching end of empire stage for this country, 100%. But again, I just take exception with this constant idea put forth by the libertarian community that, well, in fact, honestly, Iran is actually standing up to the United States and winning. If you look at what happened on day one alone, it's impossible to make that claim. Iran right now can't move a ship in or out of the strait. And while we have to move them much slower under escort than we should be, which is a problem Trump created, I agree with that. But we can. Zero, since we decided, like, nope, okay, you want to do this again? Blockade, none of your ships. Zero ships from Iranian ports have left the strait. Zero. And many of other nation-flagged ships have left the strait. But then they'll keep saying Iran controls the strait. To control means to control. All right. And I would say that the United States has partial control and the Iranians have no control. All they're able to do is interfere with the Americans' control. But here's the bigger thing, and this is something nobody's talking about. Do you know what inflation was in July 2026 for Iran? In July, 87.9%. I want you to think about that. 87% inflation. What does that mean? That means you have the internal economy under complete collapse. You literally have Iranians doing things like selling their hair or trying to rent out use of their computers as any way to scrape up any money at all to even exist. The problem with that, though, from a military strategy standpoint for the United States is the Iranian IRGC does not give one F about the Iranian people. They don't care how they suffer. However, you can't keep a country running that way. You do have to, let's say, feed your slaves is one way to look at it, right? No matter what, no matter how much power you have, the people that are working for you have to be able to eat and function and live, or you can't succeed as a ruling body. And so there's tremendous pressure here. But Iran is doing exactly what I said they would from the beginning. They're playing the long game. Can they wait out the political will of the United States, especially with a president who has about half of his own government directly in opposition to anything he does? There's a lot of reasons to be opposed here, but the Iranian view is more like this, the reality view, right, the chess view. They would be against him if he was curing cancer, so certainly we can gin up that here, right? How does this end? I don't pretend to know, but people that think like this thing here is going to be the thing that makes the United States fold up all our bases and come home or something, not effing happening, not effing happening. And what I do predict is about to happen is a attack by U.S. forces that people will have their jaws dropped by. Now, will it work? I'm not saying it'll work. I'm saying that I think we're reaching that point where all of the hawks in Orange Man's ear are like, look, you can't keep saying you're going to do this and not do this. But we'll see. But again, this idea that the Iranians who really can't cobble their shit together at all at this point, who are largely leaderless, who basically are saying different things because different parts of their country are speaking at the same time with different agendas and goals, is, you know, somehow like really standing up to the United States military. No, it's just not a thing. And that doesn't mean that we win, again, the long game. It is about political resilience and a belief that if they can just hold out, knowing that we will not do a land invasion, that eventually our elections will turn the tide for them. This is why the Ayatollah, who was blown up on day one, told every leader in Iran, name four people in your line of succession. That's why. Because that was how they were planning to do this from the get-go. So we'll see if they can make that work. But this is basically like laying siege to a castle and saying, but really the people in the castle are winning when they can't get food in or out. I don't even think people realize what just happened to the Iranians' ability to move things in and out of their country. They basically don't have a rail system outside of their country now. The only thing they can do now is bring planes in. But they can do that, and they have allies like China that are willing to give them shit to try to get them through this. So we'll see. Let's move on. Let's do something a little bit more close to home or the homestead. Let's hear from Nicole Sauce.
Well, hello, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee. And I wanted to talk to you about, especially if you are new to homesteading or raising food in your backyard or any of those things, what do you do at this time of year when everything feels like it's ripe at one time and you have way too much to eat fresh and you need to process it? And this is where I go into preparedness starts at home, and it starts with mindset. What does mindset have to do with processing food? It has everything to do with processing food at this time of year because we are at the onslaught peak. And so the best thing you can do, rather than just gronk it out like a rhinoceros, is step back and look at what you got, make a plan, execute the plan. I will illustrate how this has worked around here recently when I got a phone call from a friend. Well, I got a text from a friend saying, hey, I'm going out of town. Do you want my tomatoes? To which I said, of course I want free tomatoes, because if I'm giving full disclosure, my tomatoes have failed this year. I'm getting green beans, but I'm not getting tomatoes. And I was a little sad that we were not going to have salsa. Super stoked to get that text. One of the great things about establishing a local food network and relationships with other homesteaders around you is just this situation. She can't use them, I can. So I hopped out there, I picked the tomatoes, ended up with about 120 pounds of tomatoes, most of which were ripe, all at one time, on the hottest day of the year. So I stepped back for a second. I didn't just like jump right in and start making sauce and stewed tomatoes and salsa and all the things at one time, something I'm perfectly capable of doing. I stepped back and I thought, okay, what's important? I got customer orders at the coffee business. I've got to prepare to be out of town for a couple days. Right after that, Tactical's going out of town, so we got to have that ready. So how do I also fit 120 pounds of ripe tomatoes into my life, get sleep, get exercise, get downtime? And the answer became automatically clear. And it started as follows. One, I know that you can freeze tomatoes and then can them later. And this is something I learned from a lady named Geraldine Duncan, who wrote a lot of cookbooks. She's no longer with us, but she was amazing. And she always said, you know, tomatoes are all ripe at one time every year. And what I do is I prep them for canning and I toss them in the freezer. And you can do that for sauce, you can do that for salsa, and you can do that for stewed tomatoes. Along that lines, once you freeze them, you can speed up your sauce making, Anyway, you can speed up your sauce making activities by defrosting them and pouring off the tomato water, and then you start with a thicker sauce to begin with. Things that don't work well frozen is if you're going to go like sun-dried style, it's better just to slice those babies up and throw them in your food dehydrator or your freeze dryer, however you're going to process them that way. Actually, the freeze dryer is frozen, so it doesn't matter. But the dehydrator if you're going to do a dehydrated tomato, they do better if they haven't been frozen before you dehydrate them. So I looked at all these tomatoes, and I grabbed the box that looked like it was the ripest, and I started there, and every time I came across a tomato that was not quite ripe, I put it to the side. And I prepared, I don't know, a bunch of batches of salsa, and the way I did that was by grinding the tomatoes, because I leave skin on, seed in for the tomatoes, and then I prepared tomatoes for sauce, which is a different preparation I do. And then I ended up at the end of the day with everything in the freezer that fit in the freezer, a freeze-dry tomato powder happening. So that's just grind up the tomatoes, throw it in the freeze dryer, and then run it through the blender after. You end up with great tomato powder. It's delicious in roasts and that sort of thing. It's like less liquidy, but you get that tomato. So it richens any broth you want to richen and rich. I like the word richen better, though. And I, in fact, made a batch of salsa and canned it at the same time. And I ended up with a box of tomatoes that weren't ripe. So I had automatically just prioritized the most ripe, prepared them all the way so that future me is happy when I can just pull a batch of tomatoes out of the freezer for salsa. That's the right size for all the peppers and other things you add to that, and then also prepared for sauce and stewed tomatoes in my other secret way. It's not really secret, but if you want to hear all of the details on that, because I only have limited time here, go to show 1152 at livingfreeintennessee.com. If I had not stepped back, I probably would have been more likely to spend the next 2 days to 3 days canning, skinning, like all of the things on the tomatoes. But just stepping back for a bit, assessing how much space I had in the freezer, assessing which ones were ripe, which ones were not ripe, and planning out how much salsa I wanted and how much sauce I wanted and how much tomato powder I wanted, allowed me to get through the whole thing and also have a very delicious homemade tomato cucumber salad and go to bed on time. That's what I mean by bringing that preparedness mindset into your house before you start big things, especially when you're navigating abundance right now. It's actually well worth your time if you're new to preserving food to just step back and be like, okay, what are all the ways I can preserve this? Do I even like it? If I do like it, how do I like it? Which ways would I like to preserve it? How much time does that take? And how does that break down onto the time of day? That's how we keep things rolling here without losing our minds most of the time. Anyway, hope you liked that segment. If you do and you want to hear more, go to show 1152 at livingfreeintennessee.com. Don't forget to drink good coffee and make it a great week.
Yeah, and sometimes your production comes at the worst possible time. Here's an example. I said when I was introducing today's show that I am leaving for a couple of days. And I'll tell you one thing that doesn't last long, let's say on the vine, even though there's no vine involved, is the mushroom. So I've got two of my mushroom fruiting blocks. They're not really blocks, but I got two sets of mushrooms that right now are not going to likely be big enough to harvest in the morning before I leave. They'll be way too small, and there's a very high probability that while I'm gone, they complete their growth and begin massive rapid decline. Because once they hit that peak and you have them like on, they're still on media and they're in something like a boom room, they go downhill really fast. If they could get themselves good enough by tomorrow, I could throw them in the fridge. And then when I get home, my plan is dehydration. And the reason I even bring that up is just because it fits into what Nicole talked about. But I also think it's about time for a new show on dehydration technology and using that. People have gotten really excited about freeze drying. And I understand why. Freeze drying has always been the best and most expensive way to preserve food. But good old-fashioned dehydration, which can be done with something like a high-end Excalibur is like 300 and something bucks. A low-end dehydrator is, you know, under 100 bucks. And plenty of people have picked up dehydrators, including high-end ones, for not very much money on places like Facebook Marketplace or thrift stores and stuff like that. So it's an easily accessible technology. It also predates electricity. A box with a window and some screens and designed airflow in the sun can act very much as a dehydrator as well. So I think it's time that we go back and do that. We need to at least occasionally go back to kind of our roots on this show. So I'm actually planning on potentially doing that show either next week or the following week. Just a little heads up there. Next up, let's hear about suckas. Remember sucka? It's like Mr. T. I can't do Mr. T. But if you're an 80s kid, you know what I'm talking about, right? But we're not talking about those kind of suckas, right? We're talking about tree suckers. What's a tree sucker? Well, Nick Ferguson will tell you and tell you what you can do about it.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with a question from Tom on tree suckers. He writes, question for Nick Ferguson, is there any way to stop suckers from popping up on a well-established tree? I have a tree in my front yard that keeps getting suckers popping up from the semi-exposed roots around the base of the tree. I have an existing planter all around the tree. I must be damaging the exposed and shallow roots while maintaining the planter. The suckers have been getting progressively more numerous. I had some storm damage last year and lost a big section of the tree, so it will eventually be coming out. I ask because I want to know how to handle this problem in the future. Thanks, Tom. All right, to understand this problem and prevent it or deal with it in the future, you're first going to need to understand a little bit about tree physiology, because once you understand that, it's pretty dang simple. So what's happening is when there's damage or a cut is made, like if you prune, the tree grows special plant cells that will rapidly grow over the area and seal it off from intrusion by bacteria or fungi. It's trying to heal, essentially. It's like scar tissue. Those cells are called meristematic cells, basically like human stem cells. I'm sure you've heard of stem cell treatments and stuff. They can turn into whatever the plant needs them to be. So I know y'all have probably all heard about Jack talking about crepe myrtle murder. Basically, when they pollard the crepe myrtle trees, if you have seen them, you'll notice that those ends turn into almost like club-like looking growths, like a huge, weird-looking, gnarly thing. And most of that is going to be the meristematic cells. And they make tons of shoots because the tree is trying, literally, to get tall enough to not get eaten by whatever monster chomped the top of it off. Like if there were still mastodons and, you know, dinosaurs eating the tops of trees off, what they're trying to do is get tall enough that whatever's eating them can't eat them anymore. So those cells are what we want when we make cuttings or graft a piece of scion onto a rootstock. We want those cells to heal and bind the scion to the rootstock, or we want the cells on the bottom of a cutting, they're called callus, those turn into roots when in contact with moisture and soil in the case of the cuttings. So a lot of people will get little bits of damage to the bases, like the root flare of their fruit trees, and then what happens is the rootstock will start growing shoots out of the base of the tree, or you'll have shade trees and a lawn that have roots close to the surface or exposed, and those get run over by lawnmowers or, you know, scuffed up by foot traffic, anything like that. Any of that damage, it's going to start forming those cells right there, and what do you know, when exposed to light, it starts to grow shoots. So if it's dry, exposed to light, they tend to grow shoots. So in the future, if you have shoots growing out of the base of the fruit tree or from exposed roots, especially from exposed roots, your first goal is to rub those shoots off as quick as possible to limit the amount of damage being done. And with the roots, get them covered with mulch or soil so they don't make more shoots, just more roots. And if they do, if you see more shoots popping up, rub those off real quick, get them knocked down, and cover it back up with soil. That's basically it. Damage causes special plant cells to grow there. Light encourages shoots. Darkness and moisture encourages roots. That's how we air layer things, by providing the conditions for roots to grow even out of the ground. Great question. Hope that helped, Tom. Keep them coming. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty. Do good things.
Good stuff. And I have to say that unless it's right at the trunk, a lot of trees, you know, that's, I think, what's going on here. And so do everything Nick said. But there's a lot of trees that will sucker from the roots even with no damage, just maybe because those roots are kind of shallow, or because that is part of that tree's survival strategy as to how it survives. The locust is very well known for this and what have you. And what I would say is if you're going to plant a tree that has a predisposition to do this, again, a predisposition to do it extended out from the tree, then you need to put that tree in a place where you know that whatever you do to mow will be easy to mow around that tree. And then those suckers just aren't problems because they're nothing but little whips that the lawnmower chops up into more bits. And they may keep trying to come back forever, but good luck with the mechanical cow cutting you in half, right? Anyway, moving on, let's talk about be on the lookout guns. This is not a special gun, but it kind of is. It is for you to be on the lookout for with Mike Melito.
Hello, TSP. Michael here of Gunfighter Life Podcast. I thought a fun segment for the expert council would be gun bolos. Be on the lookout. We use that a lot when I was a law enforcement officer, but I'm pretty sure it's in the common lexicon, right? Bolo, be on the lookout for. Kicking around a gun shop, a gun show, perusing gun broker, the used section at Cabela's, website or in person, that are just kind of hidden gems. Now, inspiration for this was I did a whole episode on my podcast on more affordable alternatives to pre-64 Winchester Model 70s, the rifleman's rifle. I listed several, but I'm going to list one here for this, and that's Husqvarna. No, I'm not talking about you running down a deer with your Husky chainsaw. Husqvarna made rifles. They made really good rifles, really good controlled round feed rifles with iron sights. As you might imagine from a Scandinavian-made product rifle, it's very high quality. They are not, for whatever reason, coveted to the degree of a pre-64 Winchester Model 70. They're fantastic rifles. They come in some really cool cartridges. They come in a lot of European cartridges, like 6.5 by 55 Swede, which is a great cartridge, but they also come in American cartridges as well. But also American cartridges like 7 Rem Mag 30-06, really classic high-quality rifles. Now, I know not everybody hunts, and that's not everybody's cup of tea, so we'll try and move this along, talk about some other ones. Ruger. They make a pretty good budget AR nowadays. It's pretty run-of-the-mill, pretty standard. There's nothing wrong with those. There's a lot of really good affordable ARs in the market. We're kind of in the golden age of that. Nothing wrong with a PSA, Palmetto State Armory AR. That's not really the theme of this hidden gem. When Ruger came out with their first AR, this was when the swing to piston ARs was hot and heavy. And there are advantages and disadvantages to piston ARs versus direct impingement ARs. But if you want a piston, there's not that many left, and a lot of those can be quite expensive. They're good guns. PWS, LWRC, they're really good guns, very expensive guns. The Ruger guns are also good. Their first model that was a piston gun, and that's going to be the Ruger SR-556. These are not highly coveted. I imagine a lot of people that see them don't realize they're a piston AR unless they know what they're looking at. But very good, high quality, American-made piston AR. So be on the lookout for one of those. Next, how about we go to the world of shotguns? You probably know, if you want a reasonable rate of fire shotgun, pump or semi-auto, and there's some really good deals there too, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about bolt-action shotguns. My very first firearm ever growing up that I started hunting with, that was a gun that was given to me, was a bolt-action Mossberg 410 with the choke that you screw in and out. Is it the best shotgun out there? No. Am I telling you to go try and kick down doors with it? No. But, you know, a bolt-action is good in a hunting rifle. For a hunting shotgun or a good, versatile, affordable shotgun, there's nothing wrong with those. Now, some of them are the old goose guns, and they have ridiculously long barrels. So I don't consider those super practical for a lot. There are some really good guns that are not coveted highly, bolt-action shotguns. Not as fast as a pump, certainly not as fast as a semi-auto, but, you know, for a field gun, there's nothing wrong with a bolt-action shotgun and all the versatility that goes along with whatever shotgun of that gauge. How about a good, effective handgun? There are a lot of good affordable polymer striker fires. We're kind of in the golden era of that, and I don't even prefer a polymer striker fire. I prefer a hammer-fired gun. But for this, one that's a really good deal, especially if you find one used, because they're not that much new. The Smith & Wesson SD9VE. That's not the catchiest marketing term for a handgun, but the SD9VE is a good, solid-built, reliable, American-made, I believe stainless steel, you know, decent capacity, good, shootable, affordable handgun. So be on the lookout for one of those. How about we throw in some rimfires? Because some of the older, you know, Winchester, Remington, Marlin 22s can be quite collectible. How about Glenfield? That was a more affordable version. Sometimes they'll even be called Marlin Glenfield, but you can find some Glenfield models, or you may be able to find some if you're on the lookout for them. There's also Sears and Roebuck models and Western Auto models of 22s. These, and I'm not the biggest, you know, aficionado of these, but many of these were made by their bigger companies and sold to those department stores back in the day when you could go into Sears and just buy a rifle or a shotgun or a 22 or Western Auto Hardware store. And a lot of times these were made by the bigger manufacturers, maybe a little less of the fit and finish, but functionally the same as more well-known models that may garner a little bit more of a price tag. So just some stuff there to be on the lookout for. With that, appreciate you guys. Thanks, Jack, and have a blessed day.
I'll definitely agree where he kind of leaves off there with, like, the Sears models or what have you. Sears never made a gun in their life. All of those were major manufacturers that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of a single one that wasn't a major manufacturer. And most of them were either Winchester, Remington, or Savage was the actual company that actually was building the gun. So you're looking at older, like, if it's a Sears brand gun, you're looking at an older gun. My grandfather had a Sears and Roebuck brand semi-auto 20 gauge, and it was a Winchester clone with the external Winchester choke adjustable. This is before we had those slick tubes that go on the inside. You know, the big fat thing that almost looks like a little mini silencer on the end of some shotguns. That's what it is. And I do want to reiterate what he said about bolt action shotguns. I have a Mossberg 16 gauge bolt action shotgun. I got it for $50. And the stock looked like god awful hell on it. I brought it home. It had a cracked piece of the stock. And I basically just smoothed that out. It was on the forearm on the top, like up by the barrel. And I just took about the same amount of wood off the other side of it to balance it so it looked like it was supposed to be that way. Completely stripped it down, and it was gorgeous black walnut. The stock's probably worth more than $50. And I just did a true oil finish on it, did a little tune-up on it, and it is a beautiful little gun, $50. And it's a 16-gauge, which is kind of sweet. I'll tell you the other thing I would add to his Bolo list, though, is any 410 shotgun, especially any 410 that is not a single shot. I have a thing for those. 410 over and unders, 410 double barrels, 410 pump, 410 semi-autos. I just like the 410. But what I've noticed is when I do find one at a gun show where people, you know, because the gun show loophole, which is just private sales, which is not a loophole, every time I buy one, if I do not want to resell it, like I just absolutely do not want to be bothered about it, I literally have to leave the show, take it out, secure it in my vehicle, and come back into the show. Because I can't take more than about 50 steps without somebody tapping me on the shoulder asking me to buy it. And I've literally, like, I bought one time. It was a little Mossberg pump, and I already had pretty much the exact same one at home. And I think I paid $380 for it, something in that range, like somewhere just under $400. And a guy walked up and said, you know, do you want to sell it? I said, I just bought it. And he said, what did you pay for it? And I said, about $400, you know. Figured he'd be like, oh, I can probably find one. He goes, I'll give you $600 for it right now. Are you bullshitting? Or he pulls out bills. You bought a gun, bro, right? I mean, I'm just saying that these are highly resellable at gun shows. And even if you don't want to do it right away, like when you see that opportunity, you know, you take that gun home, but when you go to a gun show again, if you look in your collection and you've got a lot of those laying around, those sell, vendors want to buy them and, people walking around want to buy them. I don't know what makes them so desirable other than there's not that many of them, but that's just my thoughts on one more to add. So it's not a particular model, but anything other than a single shot 410, at least give it some consideration. Next up, let's say that you're retiring. Let's say you own two houses. Let's say you want to buy a big old RV and tour around, and you think, maybe I shouldn't sell these houses. Maybe I should rent them so I can hold on to the asset and get some cash flow out of them. And if I'm going to be in an RV and I don't know where I'm going to be next month, maybe it would be better if somebody else managed the property. Does it make sense to get a management company to manage your property? Antonio Gatto has tons of experience in the handyman space, the rehab space, the buy property and flip model, the buy property and rent model. It's what he does, so he's the perfect person to answer this.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you again from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I'm always happy to answer all of your questions pertaining to home improvements and real estate. And this week's question comes in from Paul in Ohio. Paul writes in, hello, Antonio. What are your thoughts on using a rental management company to take care of your rentals if you are going to be traveling remotely and sometimes without Wi-Fi or cellular connectivity? My wife and I are newly married and both own houses. I am near retirement age, and we would like to do some RV traveling in the next year or so. We have considered selling both of our houses, but have also considered renting out both houses at the same time while we are on the road to have another cash flow stream and also to have a place to come back to if we should get tired or can't stand being on the road any longer. We have never been landlords, and so dealing with all of the ins and outs of having rentals, especially while traveling all over the U.S., is a daunting task to us. What are your thoughts on using a rental management company to take care of everything while we are gone? Thanks so much for your time, Paul in Ohio. Paul, thank you very much for the question. And first off, I would just like to send my congrats to you on your retirement. I know that is a milestone achievement, and I wish you and your wife many, many fun adventures moving forward. So I'm going to approach this in the most pragmatic way as possible, Paul. Part of me feels that there may be some unrealistic expectations moving forward. And I'm only saying these because I'm just trying to protect you, protect your peace, and protect your security. So I don't have a problem with you using a rental management company. But what I do have a problem with is you considering selling both of your houses and having nothing to go back to. And I also have a problem with you leasing both of your primary residences and not having a place to come back to. Now, the idea of being on the road is great, but unfortunately, it can lose its appeal, and it does lose its appeal to many, many people over time, as it's often romanticized, and it kind of goes along with this permanent vacation mindset. Now, the data tells us that the average amount of time that retirees generally are out on the road with an RV is generally only 3 to 5 months. Now, there's a multitude of reasons for this. It is a lot of work. It's more work than most people think. There's a lot of maintenance and upkeep while you're traveling on the road. You have to potentially deal with mechanical failures. You have to have the proper hookups. You have to deal with the sewage. It can be very isolating after a while, too. And remember, you're hauling a massive vehicle down many, many roads. It can be very difficult in heavy traffic. And especially when you get into smaller towns, it can also be a challenge finding a legal spot to park them to where you will not be ordered to move as well, too. So I'm just trying to get across that I don't want you to go into this with full rose-colored glasses. And again, I am certainly not trying to rain on your parade here. I just want you to be prepared and be safe and secure. Now, my reason for telling you this is because I always want you and your wife to have a place that you can go back to at your discretion. Standard leases throughout the United States are 12 months. I personally have a feeling you're probably not going to be on the road for 12 months. So knowing that you sold both of your houses and knowing that both of your primary residences are under lease, that basically leaves you stuck with just an RV, and I don't want you to be in that predicament. It makes me uncomfortable to think that, and it also sets you up to be in a very vulnerable situation, and you are certainly in your retirement years now. You don't need that. Like I said, I always want you to have a place of security that you can go back to at your discretion. Now, if you do decide to lease one of your properties, I have no problem with using your property management company, but one stipulation, I would like you to do the screening of the tenants, you and your wife together. Now, that is not to say that you cannot interview some of the potential tenants that the property management company would throw at you, but you need to be very, very selective on this because they are going to be staying at your primary residence. And remember, there is no greater watchdog in all of your assets, and that includes your home, your money, your family, than you are. If you listen to the episode that I did back on February the 5th, that's when it was published. It's the proper screening of tenants. I would highly suggest that you and your wife go back and listen to that. I give you detailed step-by-step instructions that will certainly help you. And remember, property management companies, they're incentivized to get tenants in there quickly, so they are certainly not going to be as selective as you will be. So that's why I'm just trying to enforce that you do this and you and your wife do your due diligence, you know, to a large degree. Now, when you are interviewing companies, make sure that you inquire about their fees and ask them what all these fees cover. Get the full detailed description and make sure that you get everything in writing as well too. In real estate, you can negotiate all you want, you can agree all you want, but in the end, we have a rule. It always must get reduced to writing. Now, with that, please do not sign anything that you don't understand. I do want you to become very, very familiar with lease agreements. That is very important. You need to understand all of the terminology that goes along with that fully. And I do want you to have a separate clear rules and regulations page. Now, the property management company, they probably have a standardized version, but I want you to have one as well, too, because that's your property. If there are certain rules that you would like to see implemented that are not on theirs, certainly you can file an addendum and have that added to that as well, too. And feel free to ask them as many questions as possible. You should. That's what they're there for. And that also shows that you are actively managing. Now, what does active management mean? I always say there is nothing passive about real estate. It's active. Ask them, do you inspect the properties while we're gone? Are you going to send somebody over quarterly to check the mechanics, et cetera, things like that? That's all very important. A lot of them don't, so try to find one that does because that's very, very important. And another thing that I would like for you to do is to actually go see some of the properties before you sign on with one of the companies. Make sure that when you get there and you're observing everything, make sure that everything looks copacetic. If you show up and there's garbage in the yard, everything is unkept, potentially some dilapidated properties, that is a huge red flag. And I hate to say it, but unfortunately your house could look that way. And remember, this is very, very crucial because once you are done traveling, you don't want to ruin your reputation in your neighborhood with potential neighbors. Knowing the people that were there prior, it could create an uneasy situation with everybody too. So I'm basically just trying to protect your peace, protect you, so you always have a safe place to go back to. So I hope this helps you, Paul. If you have any other questions, feel free to reach out to me anytime. Keep those questions coming into Jack. And again, safe adventures to you. I hope everybody is having a wonderful summer. Enjoy the rest of the day. And remember, never stop learning. And we will see you on the next episode.
Okay, he went a different way than I expected there, and I completely agree with him. And it's really great that he brought something up I really didn't think about. Like, these people have two homes, and they're talking about leasing both of them out. And you know, you're in a long-term lease situation at that point. And what if you change your mind? Now, there are a couple things, and I don't know that we know enough here to be fully able to, you know, address the it depends part as to what it depends on. When you tell me you're retired and you have two homes, my mind immediately goes to significant equity, that these homes have significant equity in them. At least one of them would. It's unlikely that a person that's in this decision-making process now bought two homes in the last 5 years, is what I'm saying. It's very possible that these two properties are extremely equity-heavy, or the other possibility is they were and then they extracted equity. So that changes the calculus. Assuming they have a lot of equity in them, one of the advantages of putting them into a property management situation would be that equity, if you decided you didn't want to do this anymore, could then be extracted to fund a third home while maintaining the other assets. So there's a lot of ways to come at this. Here's another way you could come at this. There are if you have properties that make sense for Airbnb, including your primary residence, because not all do, right? Is there enough demand where you are for an Airbnb home? If you go that, or Airbnb, Vibro, it doesn't matter, any of these short-term rentals, there are companies in any place where it makes sense to do it. They specialize in this. And that way you have a situation where the person renting the home is constantly being replaced with new people. They are under very strict criteria as home users. People that are customers on Airbnb, Vibro, like I'm about to be, we get reviewed too. And so that is a part of holding it. And then so this is something I've noticed in trying to rent properties. There's a lot of properties. I'm like, well, I want to rent this for 10 days. And it says it's not available. And so I'm like, well, maybe I could rent this place for 5 days and then rent a different place for 5 days that's close by. And so I'll like, is it available for these dates? Okay, I'll bookmark it in case I want to come back to it. Let's see if I can find another property. And that same property shows up in a different date range. And then is it available for days 1 to 5? Yes. Is it available for days 6 through 10? Yes. And I'm like, well, what is going on here? Well, it turns out a lot of hosts set a limit, a hard limit on how long a rental can stay in before they have to leave. And so I don't want to rent to you for 2 weeks. They'll set it at like 7 or 8 days. And that causes more turnover, including... And I have done this in one occasion. I have rented the property and I have put in a checkout date and I have basically thrown all my shit in my car and went and done something and then came right back that same day after the place has been serviced and cleaned on a second rental because it was more convenient and less expensive than getting a second property. So the reason I even explain that is that kind of opens the idea to you that you could have a lot of control and still maybe have roll enough cash roll in to cover the expense of the property while you're not using it. And as an Airbnb host, you can log in from the road and decide, hey, we only want to leave this window open for rentals for like 3 months out. And then as you're 2-3 months into your RVing quest, if you want to keep extending it, you can black out weeks and things like that. And that way you can always have a relatively short period of time to returning back home if that's what you want to do, because I really didn't think about that. So thank you, Antonio, because he went an extra mile on that one. I really want more questions for Antonio. He's an incredible guy. Let me explain to you, if you've not heard this before, how he became part of the expert council. He came to a workshop last year. That's pretty much it. I met him. His enthusiasm and his knowledge impressed me so much. I literally asked him on the spot, like not the second I met him, but during that workshop, do you want to do this? I don't generally add people to the council that way. There's generally a lot more of a ramp up to it. This guy knows his stuff, and the more you feed him with your questions, the more he will feed you with his answers. He is completely willing to give away information that a lot of people in his space sell. I'll put it that way. All right, so let's move on now, and let's talk about one of my laws of life. This is Law 11 in Book 2, and here's a longer version of it. What is and what will be is more important than what should be and what should happen. And the reason this law is important, I think most of the laws in my books, when people look at them at the surface, at least once they fully understand, because there's some that confuse people, like on apologizing and things like that, as to what I'm actually saying. But once they understand what I'm saying, they're like, yeah, and everybody knows that. But the depth of the law is where it gets lost. How much there is into your mental computer, your background processes, right? Opening up the filter that is your thalamus. A lot of people don't know. Your brain has a part of it called the thalamus. And your thalamus is like a bouncer at a bar. And the reason for that is, and the, you know, this happens to people. I happen to have a little bit of Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autism spectrum in me, and it doesn't affect me that much now, but occasionally it will bite me. But as a kid, it would really bite me, and it's being overstimulated. So I remember being a little kid and being in a store, like a mall or somewhere, there's people everywhere, and eventually getting to a point where I literally put my hands on my head and said, I can't be here anymore. And it was because I could actually hear and track multiple conversations at the same time the way that a normal person would track one, and that's a gift, but it can be a curse because all of a sudden you can't shut it out. And it's too much coming and it's overstimulation, right? And so our thalamus is a natural barrier so that we don't get overstimulated. We filter out more than 90% of the data we're presented with. We just ignore it because we have to. And it's very hard to explain that to somebody that's never experienced being overwhelmed with just too much stimulation, too much information. But it's a real thing and it happens. And when we start digging into these laws, what we do is we bring knowledge to the front of our minds, awareness of things that we generally run as a background process. And when we do that, we generally then, on some levels, open that filter a little bit more, and we allow things in that we normally would have rejected that benefit us. So that's how one of the ways these laws go way deeper, and that's why I've put so much effort into developing the courses that go with the books. I'm hoping still to get this course out in August for book one. And I think at the end of that one, since the, if you take that course, it's like a 90-day process, right? I will probably back off doing the second book's workbook and go back to writing the AI book next. Anyway, what is and what will be is more important than what should be and what should happen. What this does is it opens up action. And that's why it's so important. So let's just look at a few places right now that we can see this playing out. People more concerned about the way things should be than the way things are, and therefore they're not taking actions that are meaningful to move forward. The youth of this country right now are very upset about our economics, and so am I. They want to blame whoever's in charge, so that's Donald Trump. But Donald Trump is not the person that changed how the monetary system worked in 1971. Okay? And it wasn't the boomers either. It was the silence and GIs who are all dead now. Right? There's like four or five of these people still kicking, and we dig them up and kill them again. They're already dead. And that it really, of course, goes back to the 30s, and it goes back even further back, 1913, when the money was corrupted by the establishment of the Federal Reserve. Okay? So we can't fix that. So you talk to these people, and their biggest complaint right now, other than student loan debt, which we're not going to dig into that one today, but is I can't buy a house. And as people start to cross their mid-20s, they start thinking that way. By the time they're getting into like their early 30s, especially when they start thinking about having children, if I'm going to have children, I want a home for them to grow up in, not an apartment. And so this becomes really important to them, and they start trying to buy a home, and they can't figure out how to do it. And I think many of them grew up in homes, especially the really angry ones right now, where their parents did really well. That makes it easy to make them hate the boomers. Look at what your parents have, and they won't share it with you. But you weren't there when your parents were slogging through shit and sacrificing to put food on the table for you, and you were too freaking young to remember what that was like. All you remember is kind of like the second half of your childhood as you grew up through high school and went off to college where your parents had made it, and you're trying to buy the home that you grew up in, and you're not going to. That was probably not your parents' first home, and if it was, they were lucky out of the gate. Most of the shit, you bought a house for $40,000 when you back in the 80s, and you wouldn't live in that house today if it was $40,000 today. That's the truth. Most of you wouldn't. So you talk to these people and you try to explain, here's a path toward home ownership. Number one, let's reduce what you think you need to spend. Number two, you don't need a trendy area where there's lots of shopping because you just told me you're broke, right? You don't need to worry about how good the schools are because you don't have any kids yet. You're minimum 6 years from caring about kindergarten. Stop pretending that matters. Get into a starter home. Now you have your feet in. You can fix it up. You can make some money when you sell it. It will be much easier to buy your second home than your first, right? And then they lose their mind. It's not fair, right? And it's not fair. It was easier for you to buy a home in the 90s than it is for me to buy a home today. That's true. It doesn't matter. And this is where this law really hits. People have become confused with the concept of who gets blame and who has responsibility, right? Everything is your responsibility, just like you would learn in a handgun course. And what I mean by that is the cause, who caused the thing, is in the past. Responsibility is in the future. And it can be unfair. There's so many things that are unfair. But to say that it's your responsibility is not equal to saying it's your fault. But the defense mechanism is to say, oh, you're saying it's my fault. And instead of saying, okay, this is, like, I'm going to accept things the way that they are. I'm going to be parasympathetic neurally instead of sympathetic. In other words, I'm going to get out of fight, flight, or freeze mode, and I'm going to get into accept and respond mode. They want to stay in that other state because it's easier, and what they really want is to commiserate. And so that leads to a direct lack of action. But if what is and what will be is the most important thing, then you are called to action. Here's another thing, and I won't completely rehash it because I went over it last week in my segment, the BIP 110 proposal, right, to change Bitcoin. You could not even care about Bitcoin. This one today should still make sense for you if you just tuned out last week. There's this proposal to change Bitcoin, and I'm basically just going to say it can't work the way it's designed. And the short version is a whole group of people in the Bitcoin space that really do care about Bitcoin and want to stop spam have been convinced that if they all go buy like a Start9 node or an Umbral node and turn it on and wait for August the 8th, they will be able to force a change on Bitcoin. Bitcoin doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. There's a mechanism called consensus. I won't get deep into it, but you need broad support, and that support has to come from, like, this is the big thing. It's easy to defend and prevent change to Bitcoin. It needs to be, right? It's difficult, therefore, to change it, right? Because it needs to be. So their whole point is, but they changed this code and it's easier for people to put spam in the background now. Okay, and that's true. But that doesn't get to the core of, well, how will your plan work? And I've asked these people like nauseam because I'm always open to being wrong, right? Can any of you explain to me how a few thousand nodes, even 10,000 nodes, which I think is way more than you have, that are non-monetary, in other words, they're not doing anything, they're just sitting there signaling, can force the network to change, to do what you want it to do when, first of all, like 90% of people in Bitcoin don't even know you exist, and they're just going to go on with their lives. And the only thing necessary to defend the current state of Bitcoin is to do nothing, right? Nothing is all that needs to be done. Again, easy to defend, hard to attack, yeah? And you have no plan. You have no support of the miners, not just the companies, the miners or the mining pools, like all of them, everybody. And understand, when I say miners, I'm not talking about six big companies. I'm talking about me. I'm a miner. I own mining rigs. The big mining company is really a data center that I pay to host my ASICs, right? I can sit here on a computer and I can change the pool I'm mining with. I can change what I'm mining. I don't have to mine Bitcoin. I just do, right? I could be mining Litecoin. Like, I have total control over my machines. I could even, like, send a tech support request and say, I want my machines moved to this different data center. They'll charge me to do it, but I'll pack them up and send them over there. So that's who miners are. So you have no support of miners. You have no support of things like the wallet manufacturers. And so you ask them, how can your plan work? And what they do is they go back to – this is the same thing that people that can't buy a house do. A lot of them, I think, are the same people. So honestly, it makes sense, right? But spam is bad, and the blockchain will bloat, and Bitcoin will die, and whatever. And it's a bunch of hyperbole, and it's so overstated any kind of problem or risk. But yeah, we would all like to get rid of spam. We're not saying we're not. We're just saying this won't work. But they will not touch the question, how can this work? They'll say something stupid like nodes are sovereign, which doesn't mean anything, okay? But they will not explain how can consensus that's been in the code since 2008 be altered when you're outside the rules of consensus. They can't answer it. Because why though? They think they're taking a meaningful action, but in their hearts they know they're not. And I'll tell you how they know they're not. I've thrown out for 2 days now to all the most vocal people, hey, how about we bet $1,000 on whether you guys succeed or not? We get a third party to hold the money, and we both send them the money, and then we set a deadline by which it's failed or not. And then at that point, that person sends the money to either me or you. And immediately I was attacked. You don't even care about Bitcoin because you offered $1,000. Those are cuck bucks. Okay, how about 0.1 Bitcoin? That's about $6,400 USD. You want to do that? Nope. All of a sudden, they're all purists from a moral standpoint. 10,000 of them, but not one of them gambles. They never gamble. I don't even buy a lottery ticket. Why? They're more concerned about what should be than what is. These are two totally different types of problems, but the same diagnostics as to what the problem is. And so the takeaway from this is, in all things in your life, you have to separate who caused the problem, the past, from who's responsible to deal with the problem, the future. And you have to understand that when you refuse to make that choice, when you reach the point where it becomes clear, okay, this is a problem that affects my life, up to that moment, up until you complain about it, and up until you identify it, up until you realize it, you can hide behind the skirt of, I didn't cause this, right? But the second you say, but it's a problem, it becomes your responsibility. And in action going forward at that point, the situation as it gets worse, that is your responsibility, and you are partially the cause of it. In other words, the minute you decided, I want to buy a house, and the way that things work right now, I can't, right? First of all, you used a terrible word there in can't, because you will find a way to fulfill that prophecy. You just told your brain, don't work on this, there's no solution, right? But you identified the problem. So at that point, there were steps you could begin to take immediately that would begin to mitigate the problem and move you closer to the goal you said you wanted. Every freaking second from that point forward that you do not take those steps, you now began to contribute to your own problem. And I challenge you to look around your life, if neither of these apply directly to you, and say, but where do they? Because all of us have this problem. I'm overweight. I wish I wasn't unhealthy. Okay. I was tricked by the food industrial complex, man. I thought McDonald's fries were good for me or whatever. I don't even care if that's all true. The day you decided, hey, this isn't what I want for myself, every day you stuffed another piece of junk food in your mouth. Every day you didn't learn more about how to be healthy and take at least one meaningful action. You now directly, and you, I would say even with some level of intentionality, contributed to your problem, right? I want to start a business. I do not think I'm going to get where I want to be in life because employment is not going to get me there. Okay? Maybe it won't. Maybe it could. But the minute you identified that, if you didn't also then turn towards, okay, now I need to learn about business. Now I need to learn how to start a business. Now I need to learn how to market a business. Now I need to figure out what I'm good at that I can build a business on, right? Every moment you don't take that step, you're focusing on the way things should be instead of the way things are. You're failing to act. So, you know, I didn't learn about running a business. I didn't know it was possible. I didn't realize how many opportunities there were. I really thought I could get ahead in a job. The education system failed me. Whatever it is, no matter how true it is, the second you hit the inflection point of saying, but I don't want this, I want that other thing, we have moved from causality to responsibility. Responsibility is in the present to the future. Causality is in the past. It doesn't matter. Somebody did you wrong. Somebody cheated you. Somebody lied to you. Somebody misinformed you, right? It doesn't matter. It's all excuse making, and it all wraps up. And this is how they run this country, by the way. This is why I'm a political atheist. The entire political process is never built on solutions. It's built on bitching about why the other side's wrong and worse, right? And so there's no solution offered. And the reason they do it to you, the reason they lie to you, is because you will freaking believe them. Sooner or later, if you're a voter, right, and you vote all the time, and when you don't get what you like, I'll vote harder next time, man, somebody's going to come along and tell you what you want to hear. And even if you don't fully believe them, you'll believe them a little bit and say, well, at least it's not this other party. And sometimes at least it's not this other person is actually a good defense. No matter how shitty Trump is, when people say, but at least it's not Kamala, right? You're making a better support for Trump than you realize you are, because that barrel of freaking word salad retardism, like, I cannot even imagine a world with that woman as president of the United States, right? Did we bomb Iraq again? Because, yeah, they would do the same shit. They would do the same shit. They always have. Democrats have bombed the shit out of everything, and the media is okay when they do it, so they actually drop more bombs. Go read your history. You'll see what I'm talking about, man. Obama bombed the shit out of some people. He also deported the shit out of people, right? It's like, there is this need that people have to just, again, focus on, but I think the world should be like this. You don't get to decide that. That would overcome the free will of other people. But I'm going to go back to the thalamus again and how you filter out information that could benefit you. The minute you stop with the bullshit and say, okay, I can't change the world, but I can change my world incrementally a little bit every day, and that has dividends over time, and it compounds to my advantage. Therefore, I am going to set this goal, this objective, whatever, this group of goals and objectives, and then I'm going to tie what are called SMART goals to those goals, right? And a SMART goal, if you've never heard the term before, stands for specific. You state clearly what you want to do, answer who, what, where, and why. Measurable, use numbers or data to track your progress. In other words, you have to, like, you have a bigger goal, and so you set at least intermediate goals in between, and you say that to get to the end goal, this goal must be accomplished in 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. And so you measure that and track your progress. Achievable. The goal has to be realistic. The goal cannot be, I want to be a millionaire by 40, your net worth is $5, and you're 39. Right? That's not a SMART goal. That's a dream. So it's got to be achievable. Relevant. The goal matters to you and fits your big picture needs. In other words, you can't set a goal and say, oh, I did something, if it doesn't actually move you toward the bigger thing that you say that you want and time bound. There has to be a deadline, a clear end date where this isn't working and it needs to be retooled, right? Or I just need to admit that I'm not going to do it. And if you do that, you can't change the world. You can change your world, right? Gandhi, be the change you want to see. You think it was only about like some big political flowery thing? No, it puts the ball right in your hand and says, okay, what are you going to do about it? And the amount of energy that people spend to avoid this self-confrontation exceeds the amount of energy necessary to actually get some of the things done. People will spend more time putting up their own psychic shields against themselves than actually going out in the world and accomplishing something. And why? Here's the thing. They have been so gaslighted and brainwashed, they actually don't believe that they can. And so since they don't believe that they can, they want somebody else to fix it. And they want to contribute in some way, so they pick some little meaningless thing to do, like a post on social media or throwing some code on a Bitcoin node. And then saying, like Ralphie in The Simpsons, I'm helping. You're not. And when anybody breaks through the facade, they respond with anger, and they respond with name calling, and they respond by pretending not to understand, and they respond with bullshit that's made up, or they respond with things that are true but not relevant or germane to getting what they want. Again, the amount of energy, the mental energy alone required to maintain this position is so extreme. If they would move from sympathetic to parasympathetic in their thinking, which is response mode instead of react mode, what could they accomplish? What could they accomplish? And so when you tell me I'm 29, I'll never own a home, and I have a good job, and I can point to another 29-year-old who's buying a home right now who has about the same amount of income you have and lives somewhere near you, how can you say that? You're watching somebody else do it. I bet you're going to say they should have to pay more taxes so I can have a house or something like that. No, they're in the same game you are, the same age bracket. They had more money to put down. Maybe they got their shit together when they were 18 instead of 28. If you didn't start getting your shit together at 28, you're not going to catch up to a 28-year-old who got their shit together at 18. You're going to catch up at about, you know, it won't be quite 10 years because you have hopefully higher income. But you're still looking your years behind. It's not fair. I don't care. Doesn't matter. The past, that's what was done, right? And you may be responsible for or may not be responsible for, but the future from this point forward, now that you've identified the problem, it lays in your lap. It's all on you. That's responsibility from here forward. All right. With that, guys, I'm going to wrap up. Hope you enjoyed today's show. If you did, one of the ways you can help out is by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z. tspaz.com. If you go there and you start your shopping there, no matter what you buy, you'll help us out. Right now, I want to also remind you about my books. The Laws of Life book series, book one and book two. Many of you have read book one. I'm going to promise you that the second edition of it is totally worth it. Things are cleared up with Amazon as best I can make them. If you're on the page for book one, but it's not the second edition, it says right in the description, do not buy this book. And just under there is a link to click that will take you to the real second edition for the soft cover. I recommend that you really consider the hardcover of both books because they're just so much nicer and they're not that much more. And I say that as the guy that will make a little less money if you buy both the hardcovers than buy both the softcovers, right? I actually make less profit because of how the pricing structure works and the underlying cost of production. But they are both great books. Book two, though, I really, 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 really recommend, man. This is the closing segment today. It was all based on just one chapter of that book. This book, I really believe, has a radical power to change lives and mindsets. And the mindset is what drives life. And especially if you have someone in your life like the people I described, the people who are focusing on what should be versus what is and planning for a real world based on that and understanding responsibility is this point forward. And you have somebody like that, they may never listen to you, but they might read a book. And they might learn from it. Plant a seed with one of the copies of my books. You can go through tspaz.com when you do that. Again, Laws of Life Book 1 and Laws of Life Book 2. Both are available on Amazon now. Thank you for tuning in today. Hopefully by now I'm rolling into our Airbnb down there near Freeport. We're actually not in Galveston. We're just a little bit outside of Galveston to the south. And tomorrow, if you're listening to this anyway, as it was published, tomorrow hopefully my grandson and I will be bobbing around in the ocean and yanking in black-tipped sharks and hammerheads and stuff like that. Anyway, take care, guys. Have a great day, and I'll definitely be checking in on social media from the road in this fishing trip. So if you want to follow along, please do that. We'll be back on Tuesday next week with another new show. And again, that might be on dehydration and storage.
Said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.